5 o'clock, 5 after 5 on the 21st of March, with the special, House Special Committee of the Exxon Valdez Claim Settlement, please come to order. I would like to welcome everybody. We are on teleconference, and I noticed a number of our members are in Finance Committee, so I think we will not have our usual attendance here. I would like to welcome the members of the committee who are here, Representative Vice Chair, Representative Dave Donnelly, Representative Gail Phillips, myself, Max Gruenberg, and Representative Lauren Lehman, who is not a member of the committee officially, but I guess we'd sort of say ex officio since he is welcome and participating. And we are on teleconference. I'd like to remind all of the sites that this is a chance for the public to listen to these first proceedings here. We are, and I would invite Ms. Pamela Finley, the Assistant Revisor of Statutes from the House Legal Counsel, who has been walking us through the various agreements, to come and join with us once again. We are getting an update on these agreements, and then we will, at that point, in the next few days and weeks, be hearing from the parties to the agreement, the Attorney General for the State of Alaska, the representatives from the Exxon constellations of companies, and the federal government. And then, after we have heard from them, there will be ample opportunity for the public around the state to participate and actually testify. But until that occurs, these hearings are open to the public, but are listen only for people in the general public and also our friends and neighbors who are here present in Juneau. So with that, I'd also like the record to reflect, we have Representative Cabina, who represents the Prince William Sound area. And we'd like to invite Ms. Finley to continue her presentation, but in accord with this committee's finest traditions, we usually open it with the opportunity for questions that were left over unasked and unanswered from the last session. And I'd invite any of the members who have leftover questions to signify now if they wish to ask any opening questions. Hearing none, Ms. Finley, welcome.
Thank you. I'll start with the release. With the release of claims by the governments, which is paragraph 13 on the consent decree. In this, the state and federal governments give up all their civil and administrative claims they have against Exxon arising out of the oil spill. This includes all the claims that the state has made in state court under state law, except for the fisheries business tax, which we discussed last time. I can go through that again. The gist of it is the state can sue, continue to sue Exxon in that state court for the fisheries business tax, but in terms of actually getting the money from Exxon, it can only get the amount that would have come back to the local governments. If Exxon, in its generosity, decides to pay the rest, I suppose that's fine, but that, all the state would be entitled to is the local share. On the questions on this one, I would note that in the state case, the state has asserted claims for lost revenue from salmon enhancement tax, loss of oil and gas production tax, loss of corporate income tax, loss of oil production royalties as well. And these claims will be given up as to Exxon. One of the questions, I think, is would the state have been able to prove this claimed loss of revenue? Was there any real loss? It may just have been something that was put in the complaint, but when they looked at it, there wasn't any. On the other hand, they may actually be giving up something as to Exxon. The other question I think I had is, does the state intend to continue litigating against the other defendants in the state case? And if so, does it expect to be successful? One reason why I ask that is some of those other defendants, the claims against them may really be derivative from the claims against Exxon, so that they really might not be available anymore, but that is a question which I would address to the Attorney General. Also, I would note there are some exceptions in this release of claims. They say that it is not supposed to affect private litigants and the Alaska Native villages. I noted that they specifically said Alaska Native villages, and I wondered if there were any other groups whose claims would be affected by this settlement, though they might fall under the other exception. It may not be all that important. Also, I think one consideration is that although the consent decree says that it may not, that it will not affect third-party claims, that's from a legal standpoint. It shouldn't have any effect on them. But there may be some practical effect on those third-party claims that the legislature would want to consider, so that is also an issue that the committee may want to look at. The paragraphs 14 and 15, in these, the governments give up their civil and administrative claims against Exxon Pipeline, except to the extent that Exxon Pipeline is liable because of its interest in Alyeska. And this interest that Exxon Pipeline has in Alyeska kind of complicates this agreement, as we'll see in a little bit. But essentially, they're giving up their claims against Exxon Pipeline to the same extent they give them up against Exxon. And also, they agree not to make any civil claims against Exxon or Exxon Pipeline's employees, directors, or officers that relate to the oil spill. This provision would not be valid if the employee or officer brings an action against the state. The state could counterclaim. However, if the state or federal government obtains a judgment against that officer or employee, the government will collect only on the judgment to the extent that it's covered by insurance policies purchased by the individuals, which means essentially Exxon isn't going to have any liability for these employees. From the way that it is structured, the emphasis on a consent not to sue rather than a release, which is kind of a technical difference, I just was wondering if there was any civil case pending against an employee, director, or officer of Exxon or Exxon Pipeline, or just perhaps out of curiosity. The next paragraph is the reopener for unknown injury.
Wait. The two provisions the three provisions, paragraphs 13 through 16, are a very, very essential part of this, and that they release the defendants.
Yes.
And they are intended to be probably as broad as possible here. And before we just move ahead, I want to be sure that no member of the committee has any questions at this point in time, knowing that there will be ample opportunity to ask later. I'd like also the record to reflect the presence of another member of the committee, Representative Davidson. Representative Phillips, did you have a question?
No, Mr. Chairman, just the fact that we would be able to come back as questions develop later on those two sections.
Always. We will run this committee as democratic with a small d manner as possible, and anytime anybody has any question on any subject, that will be entertained, please. Representative Lehman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a question for Ms. Finley. When we say in here state, does that include all political subdivisions of the state?
Ms. Finley.
I believe it would only include the state government itself, the claims that the state of Alaska has, as opposed to the claims that a particular entity within the state of Alaska would have. To the extent that a local government's action is derivative, then you might be extinguishing the claim, too. But if they have a claim that's separate from the claim of the state, then I would expect that you wouldn't be extinguishing that.
You don't see anything in here that extinguishes those claims of
No, before I give you an absolute answer on that, I'd like to look at that question. I think that is an important point, and I am reluctant to give you an off the cuff.
Oh, you're okay?
Okay. I'd move on to the reopener for unknown injury. As you know, the main amount of payment is $900 million less some of Exxon's cleanup costs. This is the extra $100 million that takes it up to $1 billion. Under this, in addition to the other payments, Exxon shall pay up to $100 million. It's not necessarily $100 million, but up to that amount, needed for restoration projects to restore one or more populations, habitats, or species, which, as a result of the oil spill, have suffered a substantial loss or decline in the oil spill areas if, one, the cost of the restoration project is not grossly disproportionate to the magnitude of the benefits, and if, two, the injury to that population, habitat, or species could not have reasonably been known or anticipated by any trustee from information available to the trustee basically in mid-March of this year. And that that second qualification, that the injury could not have been anticipated by the trustee, is, I think, the thing that makes it very unlikely that the state will get this $100 million. I don't say that it's impossible. And again, it's a very good thing to have this clause in there, but I would not rely on it because of the difficulty in showing that you could not have anticipated this particular injury. I think that might come up if the oil appeared in some very unusual place that no one could have anticipated it would have shown up there. Or if you perhaps if you found some species that no one knew existed, that might be one possibility.
Questions? Representative Davidson, then Representative Phillips, Representative Lehman, then myself.
So, Ms. Finley, I understand that we're finding some hydrocarbons showing up in the livers of the pollock, for example. This is a bottom feeder, and it was thought at first that there was no problem with bottom feeding fish getting involved with the hydrocarbon situation. Would something like that, since it has come to light after initial damage assessments, would that fall in under this clause?
Well, they talk about reasonably been anticipated by any trustee from any information available to the trustee on the effective date. The effective date being somewhere near mid-March of 1991. So if that information was available to the trustee before then available sort of in, I wouldn't have to say it would have to be general knowledge, but that in the scientific community, if you know about it, probably they would think that the trustee ought to know about it. Mm. So that the hydrocarbons in the liver of the pollock would not show up. In addition, there's probably some question about if the nature of bottom fish and the nature of oil is such that you might have anticipated that the oil would have ended up in the pollock, then even that would preclude you from proceeding under this section, even if you hadn't actually found it in their livers. If the scientific knowledge about pollock and the scientific knowledge about what happens to oil, where it goes down, in other words, that it would end up on the bottom, could end up on the bottom, then it's probably going to be very difficult. I mean, I don't want to prejudice any case by saying, no, that couldn't possibly be covered, but it's just going to be difficult to prove because you're going to have to talk about information that was available up to now, at least. If any of that information would have given the trustee some reason to think that damage might have occurred, then probably this reopener would not cover it.
So the anticipation factor here is very narrow indeed.
I would think so. I'm not saying that you couldn't recover under it under any circumstances. It's just going to be difficult to do so.
Thank you.
Representative Phillips, Representative Lehman, and myself.
Pam, I don't see any time frame on this reopener clause for Exxon to be held liable for this. 25 years down the line, 50 years down the line, is there?
No, I believe it is not that.
No,
it's between September 1 of 2002 and September 1 of 2006, Exxon shall pay. I probably should have put that in the specific, but it does have a time on it.
Representative Phillips, does that complete your question?
Yes, thanks.
Representative Lehman?
My question is related to paragraph number 1. If the cost of restoration is grossly disproportionate to the benefit, I assume there's some way to tag a dollar figure on the magnitude of the benefit. Otherwise, I don't know how we compare cost with benefit. And if we do so, the way it's written now, we can't even recover the cost of the benefit. And let's say, for example, if I get in an automobile accident, somebody else is responsible, and it costs more to replace the car than just to pay me the book value of the car, then I just pay the book value, whether I like it or not, that's the way it is. And the way I see it here is the state doesn't even get book value.
This is more limited to restoration projects. That it has to. It is the money can only be spent for restoration projects, which would might include replacement value if you were going to replace one kind of snail with another, something like that. That might come under restoration. So you might get. But I don't know how you put a book value on species and populations anyway. I think it's difficult. And the question of grossly disproportionate is probably one that, if there's going to be a dispute about it, it's going to be decided by the court. I suppose an extreme example is if you're going to have to spend $5 million to rehabilitate a species of snails of which there were only 30, and which no one used, and it didn't really involve the rest of the ecosystem, but that might be considered grossly disproportionate. And obviously if you have to spend $5 to completely rehabilitate a species, that's not going to be. And where the line gets drawn in between those two is probably going to be a matter of dispute between the parties if they ever try to rely on this, the state ever tries to rely on the reopener clause.
Does that complete your question? Okay, I have a few questions in this provision. Some of the questions thus far have shown the difficulty of drafting of this particular section. I think this was a difficult section for the attorneys to draft. And it's particularly difficult because looking at the provisions, for example, that Representative Lehman has focused on, the magnitude of the benefits, that phrase, that does not imply to me merely financial benefits. because there may be, they would not otherwise say the value of the benefits or financial benefits or something. With respect to the development of law in this area, this is a very fast developing field of law, and this is approaching the frontiers of legal thinking at this point. How do you value wildlife that have no financial value? I would anticipate in the next 10 or 15 years there will be immense strides forward by the courts and legislatures in this area. My question is, will this phrase be construed according to the law in the spring of 1991, or at the time the case is litigated 10 or 15 years from now, when the law may be considerably different than it is today? What do you think?
Well, all I can do is give you a guess on that as to what a court's going to do some years down the line. I would say if the magnitude of the benefits does not have a very specific, very narrow legal meaning at this point, that the courts are going to kind of incorporate any subsequent developments in the law into that phrase. There's always the problem you don't want to remake the agreement of the parties. And if they meant something by magnitude of the benefits and they knew what that meant, then you probably want to stick with that if you're a judge. But on the other hand, if magnitude of the benefits is one of those phrases that doesn't really have a specific meaning at this point in time, then probably they would just try to get the general drift of what the parties meant and use the development of the law since that time.
This brings me to another question, and I'm raising these because these are legal issues that I want the committee members and the public to consider. We talked last time about who drafted this, and I think it's important. Does this agreement or any other agreements contain a clause that is sometimes found, and you know my question, you're nodding and smiling, that agreements sometimes say, this agreement shall not be construed against any party, because the normal rule is whoever drafts has the agreement construed strictly against that party. Does this contain such a provision?
I don't remember any clause like that. I think I can give you a definite no, it does not.
Then I think it is important to determine who drafted each provision, particularly this kind of a provision here. And that's something I want the list of issues to contain too, please. Another question that was, I think, in line with maybe what Representative Davidson was talking about, the question of could the damage have, quote, reasonably been anticipated, unquote. That's a different question from whether it could, quote, reasonably have been known. That's one step farther, not knowledge but anticipation, which doesn't necessarily imply knowledge. Are you familiar with other contracts containing that type of a clause?
Usually what one has is known or reasonably could have been known.
Right.
That is a much more familiar term to me. I would suspect that the use of the word anticipated was deliberate, because it is such a common thing to say, known or reasonably should have known. And I think the known has more to do with, we know there are hydrocarbons in the livers of these pollocks, whereas anticipated is, well, we know pollock eat off the bottom, we know oil sinks, couldn't we have anticipated putting those two together? And that is why I think anticipated is used, and that is why I think that it's very hard, it's going to be difficult to take advantage of this section. I don't say it all impossible, and I certainly don't want to prejudice the state's case some years down the road, but I do think that the legislature should not rely on this money. It should not really count it as something which is definitely going to come to it.
Thank you. The interest, is there going to be interest earning on this fund?
The $100 million, it's an up to for the restoration. This is not paid until, well, actually several things have to happen. The governments have to file their plans for the projects, their statement of the claim costs, and the information that they relied on in preparing the plan and cost estimate. This money is going to be sitting in Exxon's bank account and will only come out of it in the early in the next century.
Suppose Exxon is dissolved in the end.
Well,
goes bankrupt or something. I know none of people think that could possibly happen, but let me assure you, the question is reasonable anticipation here.
Well, if Exxon goes bankrupt, then I have it down here as a question, are these debts dischargeable in bankruptcy? And I have not answered that question because I have not specifically researched it. Preparing these things has kept me busy enough. But I can tell you my guess is that it would be dischargeable in bankruptcy.
Representative, you had a question?
No.
Other questions on this provision? Representative Phillips?
Pam, let me just clarify something. The $100 million is on top of the $1.1 billion or whatever the total amount is in the consent decree?
No. Well, it's on top of the $900 million. It's on top of the other amount, and the other amount equals $900 million less Exxon's cleanup costs, as we've discussed. So even if Exxon didn't have any cleanup costs, if you didn't deduct that, and so you say, okay, this is the full $900 million is going to be paid, then what you're getting up to is $1 billion with this, this extra $100 million.
Thank you.
Please get to it.
And that I'll clarify that. That's in the consent decree. There's another $50 million that is supposed to flow to the state from the plea agreement in the criminal case. I've seen the figure 1.2, and I'm not sure where it's coming from.
The members should recall that there are a total of three agreements here, at least.
I'll move on next to the releases and covenants not to sue by Exxon in exchange for us letting them out. They are going to let us out. They give up all their civil and administrative claims they may have against the state and federal governments. This doesn't affect Alyeska, any claims that Alyeska may have against the governments. Alyeska is really out of the picture here in general in this consent decree, but because Exxon Pipeline is a part owner, there are several provisions where it does get pulled in. I don't know what specifically what claims they've asserted. I understand that they probably have to do with the state's not doing the right thing after the oil was spilled. The next section concerns the Trans-Alaska Pipeline Liability Fund. And I thought I ought to explain this a little bit before we go into the provisions of the consent decree. This is established by federal law, and it consists of a nickel per barrel fee on the shipment of oil through the Valdez facility. The fee is not paid once the fund balance reaches $100 million, and it's imposed again when it falls below. It's a lot like the state's fund that way. The owner or operator of a vessel and the fund are strictly liable for damages sustained as a result of discharges of oil from the vessel if the oil was transported through the Trans-Alaska Pipeline and placed aboard the vessel at the Valdez loading facility. However, the strict liability of the fund may not exceed $100 million, so that's where you stop. And the first $14 million is the responsibility of the owner and the operator. So the fund ends up being responsible for the amount between $14 and $100 million. The interesting part about this is that the fund may proceed against the owner and operator of the vessel or third parties if the negligence of any of these caused the damage. Now, with that in mind, what the consent decree provides is that Exxon's release of the governments does not bar a claim that Exxon may have against this fund. So Exxon is reserving its rights to go back and get some money out of this fund. It also provides, however, that if the fund asserts claims against the government, presumably based on the negligence of the governments and not allowing quick enough cleanup or something like that, the money that the fund actually pays to Exxon, Exxon will then repay to the governments for any liability they may have to the fund. So Exxon can go get money from the fund. If the fund decides to sue the state, Exxon will give some of that money back. Anyone yet? It is confusing.
Representative Davidson.
So,
you have to flip it on.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, I mean, there's a pot of money sitting here, right? Or will be probably soon. So Exxon has the ability to go get money from that fund. And they would only have to pay it back to that fund if the state went after Exxon to force them to pay it back. Is that what you're saying?
No, the fund is a kind of a tax on the flow of oil, really. And the money comes into the fund as the oil flows through the pipeline. Exxon may think it has some claim to this fund based on somebody that someone else was negligent, and therefore it's been held responsible, but it gets money back from the fund. I'm not quite sure of the strength of Exxon's case here. I don't.
Well, what was the reason for allowing Exxon access to the fund in the first place?
Well, that's what the fund. We didn't allow Exxon access to this fund. This fund is set up under federal law, and if they think that they have a claim against it under federal law, we are saying that this consent decree doesn't stop them from going after it.
Okay.
But we're not saying that they get the fund because
this is not the 470 fund. This is something else.
No, this is something else. It's a U.S. fund that was set up when the Trans-Alaska Pipeline went through.
Okay.
It's not our fund.
Do you know? Have you heard anything as to whether or not the company is in fact going to go after some of those funds?
I don't know. I don't, and those questions I would really prefer to have answered by someone who knows a lot more about this than I
okay.
do. I was just trying to explain to you
why
they bothered to have this kind of provision in here at all.
Thank you.
Also, if Alyeska goes after some money from the fund, and the fund says to the, goes after the state for having been negligent in not allowing a quick enough cleanup or something similar, that then Exxon will repay 20.34% of whatever liability the government has to the fund. The reason for that is, again, that Exxon Pipeline owns 20.34% of Alyeska.
Representative Phillips.
Pam, that fund would be accessible to anybody who is part of the agreement. I mean, it's not limited to just Exxon, would it be? Whoever is involved with the transportation of oil in the pipeline.
People injured by the spill, in essence.
But the fund itself is not necessarily just limited to this event.
No.
Thank you.
Now we'll move on to, and if there are no more questions about that fund, we'll move on to Alyeska, which gets, in some ways, even more confusing. Here the governments give up claims they may have against Alyeska related to the oil spill for natural resource damages and damages for injury to natural resources. The question that came to mind when I read that is that that's very different language than when they're giving up claims against everybody else. Are they reserving, is the state reserving claims against Alyeska for some other kinds of losses, possibly economic losses? It's just a question I have. Again, it's probably one that the Attorney General can at least give you some answer to much more quickly than anybody else can. In addition, the consent decree provides that if Alyeska pays Exxon for claims relating to the oil spill, and Alyeska then recovers from the state or federal government all or part of what Alyeska paid Exxon, then Exxon is going to complete the circle and pay the amount the government's back that amount. This problem is caused because Alyeska is really not a party to this agreement. We're releasing them from something. We suspect they may come and sue us, and we may have to pay them, and then Exxon is going to pay us back. That's roughly the way it works. In paragraph 23, the government agreed.
Before we go on.
Yes, I'd like the record to reflect also that Representative Ulmer has joined us from the Finance Committee. Welcome, and Representative Davidson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Finley, provision 22. What does the effect of this provision have on third-party litigants? Can they still go after Alyeska?
Yes, this is the state giving up its claim, or the, both governments really giving up their claims for damages to injury to natural resources. I would not see it. The agreement in general says that it is not supposed to prejudice third-party rights, and I would think this too would not. It's really under the state's claims.
So by the state or by the governments agreeing to this, it really has no reflection on whether there is any guilt or any wrongdoing by Alyeska. Is that correct?
That's right.
Thank you.
Other questions? Please continue.
In paragraph 23, the governments agree that if either of the governments sues Alyeska and gets some money, that they will tell Alyeska to pay 20.34% of that amount to Exxon. So the state sues Exxon, the state sues Alyeska, the state gets money from Alyeska, 20% of that's supposed to go to Exxon. Again, I guess the rationale for that is that is to try to equalize the Exxon's interest in all of this. And that somehow we shouldn't be getting, if we're going to get it back, then they should get back their percentage too. I'm not trying to justify it on that, I think that's just the explanation for it. And then in paragraph 24, Exxon and Exxon Pipeline agree to repay the governments 20.34% of any amount that Alyeska recovers from the governments.
So
once again, you have, as I say, the existence of Alyeska has complicated this agreement. And then paragraph 25 finally covers situations where Alyeska sues the state or federal governments for Alyeska's own damages, or because Alyeska is liable to some third party, perhaps a fisherman, something like that. In this situation, Exxon will then pay the governments the amount that the governments paid Alyeska if the government asserts in good faith all defenses and doesn't refuse a good faith proposal to settle, which those two I think are probably pretty reasonable conditions on that. So that Exxon might pay back some third-party claims if Alyeska is kind of in the middle of them. Short question, short answer.
Representative Davidson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So a situation where someone sues Alyeska because they were not abiding by the regulations of having a barge response ready, and then Alyeska can come back to the state for not pursuing the company itself enforcing that response readiness?
Well, or for, I guess the argument would be that the state somehow interfered with it. This document and my comments don't reflect any assessment of whether or not those claims are good. They simply say if somebody sues Alyeska and Alyeska then sues the state and recovers, then Exxon is going to pay the state. So it's not a reflection on the quality of Alyeska's claims against the state. It's just a recognition that that might happen and they want to take care of it.
Well, why doesn't Provision 22 completely resolve Alyeska? Because it says then in 23, in order to resolve as completely as practicable all civil claims of governments arising from. Why isn't 22 sufficient, and why then does 23, 24, and 25 necessary to continue to expand that protection of Alyeska?
Well, they're giving up, the governments are giving up their claims, but they still have to deal with third-party claims. It's a claim from a fisherman's group or someone like that. And then, I might as well explain it now because we're just about to get into it. And it's a kind of confusing area of the law. If A sues B and B says, well, okay, I understand that I may be liable to you, but C is also responsible for this. And if I have to pay, if I, B, have to pay A something, then I want C to pay me some or all of what I have to pay A. So I pull in C into my lawsuit. And that's called what lawyers usually call third-party practice. You're pulling another litigant in. And if I, B, am seeking to get back everything that I have to pay A, usually refer to that as indemnity. And if I'm seeking to recover just a part of it, you usually refer to that as contribution. And it kind of depends on whether B has any fault or not. So these 23, 24, and 25 are in large part trying to deal with those kind of third-party claims. And it is confusing, but I think they probably felt that they needed to deal with it because they were caught out there in potentials, and they wanted to have everyone understand everyone's responsibilities right up front. It gets more interesting when you get into the third party. We're just really talking about Alyeska here, which is a much more complicated business since Alyeska is kind of part of Exxon Pipeline, but not.
Does 22, 23, 24, and 25 do anything to protect the state from third party litigants?
Well, they don't stop the third party litigants from coming and suing the state. They just say that if you sue the state, and if the third-party litigant comes in and sues the state and the third-party litigant recovers, in some of these situations, then Exxon will repay. But these are all tied to Alyeska. I think if you want to get into the third-party litigation, that's the next part. These provisions, 22 through 25, cover intercorporate suits and some third-party claims if Alyeska is involved. But the other paragraphs 26, 27, 28, 29, and 30, cover general third-party lawsuits.
Does that complete your question?
Thank you, sir.
This is just a general question. Does this agreement have to meet the requirements of Alaska law? It was drafted and signed in Washington, D.C. Interesting choice of law questions. I don't need an answer now, but Mona, I'd like you to add this to the list, please. The question is, what law would be applied in the construction of the agreement, since it does not contain a choice of law provision? What second question, and Mona, all of this should be added to your list, should be, what law will be applied in the execution and enforcement of the agreement? And third is, does this have to meet the requirement of Alaska law?
Could you clarify that a little bit about what you mean, the requirement as to consideration and those sort of things, to formation?
No, under traditional choice of law theory as opposed to locus type theory, often the situs, unless there is a choice of law provision in the agreement, and I'm surprised there was not, unless there is, often the situs of where the law, where the contract was drafted and signed would govern the construction of the document itself. However, if it is anticipated to be performed in another jurisdiction, questions concerning performance will be governed by the situs of the jurisdiction where it is to be performed. And here we have Exxon, which may be a Delaware corporation. I don't know what Exxon is. Exxon Shipping, which may be, I don't know what it is. Alaska, the federal government, all sitting down in a hotel room in Washington, D.C., drafting an agreement to be performed largely in Alaska. And I think we need to have some of those esoteric questions that we all forgot about after law school answered. Other questions, Representative? Okay.
This is bringing back nightmares for me.
At some point, I'll discuss my career in choice of law with you, too. Pam, go ahead.
Yeah, I'll move on to third-party litigation. I just break this down. Paragraph 26 governs cases where a third party sues X.
I'm sorry, and I didn't ask the final issue, which was, we led up to it. Is this governed by, does it have to meet the requirements of Alaska law? And the final question is, does this constellation of agreements in any manner violate any of the laws they must be under? Not only Alaska law, but if, in fact, they are governed in the construction of this agreement by the law of, say, Washington, D.C., where this was drafted, I want to know whether it is violative in any respect of Washington, D.C. law or any other law that would apply. Anyway, sorry to interrupt. We'd like to recognize Representative Finkelstein. Welcome him to the committee, too. Go ahead.
Paragraph 26 governs cases where some third party sues either Exxon or Exxon Pipeline and one or both of the governments. So you have the oil company and a government as defendants in a lawsuit for damages related to the oil spill. And in this case, what they say is that each party is required to pay the amount allocated to it in the judgment by the third party and will not try to sue the other party for the contribution and indemnity sort of arguments that I explained earlier. So it's sort of, if we're both sued, then we both just live with whatever judgment is and we don't go against each other. Under paragraph 27 covers situations where Exxon is sued by a third party, but neither the government is. In that case, Exxon will not seek to hold the government liable for any amount it has to pay. It will not seek indemnity or contribution from the state. The same, however, is true if one or both of the governments is sued for something related to the oil spill and neither Exxon or Exxon Pipeline is a party. The governments will not seek indemnification from Exxon. And I think this is something which has been of concern to members of this committee, if I've been understanding questions correctly. And that is that if some resident of Alaska decides to sue the state of Alaska, or some non-resident for that matter, if some private person decides to sue the state of Alaska for damages related to the oil spill under the theory that the state didn't do something it should have done, and they recover from the state, then the state is going to have to pay it out, and it's not going to be able to go over and say, Exxon, this is really all your fault, or at least this is mostly your fault. Please give us money back that we had to pay this person over here. And what it means is that that $72 million that the state is supposed to get for reimbursement may be the only pot of money out of which those judgments can really be paid. That in the general fund, I mean, whatever else you're getting, you're not going to be able to come back against Exxon for it. So when you evaluate how much money you're getting, you may also want to look at what really is your potential liability to other people, and how much you might have to pay for third-party lawsuits against the state. One can hope that third-party litigants will be aware of these kind of provisions and just go sue Exxon and not us, because it does really put a lot of the power in the plaintiff's hands to whether or not they choose to bring suit against the state or against Exxon.
Representative Kubina.
You said individuals, but you mean also any third party,
any,
other cities,
I'm sorry,
governments?
Yes, third parties in general. Okay. Paragraph 28 simply says that the amount that Exxon has to pay a third party will not reduce any of the payments that are required, which is good standard provision. Paragraphs 29 and 30 are interesting in that neither of these paragraphs is explicitly, in its language, limited to the lawsuits related to the oil spills. All the others have been. I suspect that this was a drafting error and that both of these should be, because I would hope that it was a drafting error, but it was nevertheless one you ought to be aware of. I don't mean to be looking down my nose at the drafter, because this is a very big document, but it does bother me. Paragraph 29 provides that the parties will not tender each other as defendants under Rule 14C of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure.
What does that mean?
What is this? This is a rule that's applicable to admiralty and maritime law, and what it does is normally, as you know, the plaintiff sues the defendant then pulls in someone as a third party, but that third party is a third party defendant, is a defendant as to the person as to the original defendant. What 14C does is it allows the defendant in the original case to pull in a third party and make that third party a defendant as to the original plaintiff.
They can do that under regular civil law, an involuntary defendant. Same thing, sounds like.
Yes, it's that provision. Essentially, it's saying that we're not going to pull each other in as defendants.
But it's limited solely to admiralty. I'm not familiar with that federal
14C
rule.
Does appear to be an admiralty and maritime provision. Just that.
And the term tender somebody as a defendant is a foreign term to me.
It's a foreign term to me, except when you're talking about retailers and wholesalers and expecting indemnity. One tenders one's defense, but to tender someone as a defendant is a peculiar term. I read the 14C doesn't actually use that terminology, but I think that's what they're referring to. When I read 14C, that was all I could figure out.
Ms. Findley, back to paragraph 28. If you believe that contains a typographical error or a drafting error, please make certain that we continue to cover that, and Mona, make a list of that, please, because that's the first type of an error of this type I recall you're saying.
Right. It's actually, I have listed this in the questions here, so it will be picked up. It's number 3. Paragraphs 29 and 30 are not limited to lawsuits related to the oil spill. And I suspect that's an oversight, but I just want, it should be considered as to how likely court is going to enforce it. It may not matter too much as to the maritime, but as to paragraph 30, this covers situations where a third party settles with Exxon, then sues one or both of the governments. And in such cases, the governments have to try to apportion their fault without joining Exxon as a defendant. If the court does not allow that, the governments may join Exxon for the purposes of allocating the fault, but may not enforce any action against Exxon as a result of the allocation. Now, this is a long way of saying you can't come back against us for any judgment that's rendered against you. But again, as I say, this isn't related to the oil spill. By its terms, it does not. So that any case where anybody settles anything with Exxon, theoretically this would apply. Though I will confess that if I were a judge sitting at the case, I would limit it to oil spills, because it doesn't make any sense to have a general provision floating around in this agreement. The next provision that concerns interest for late payments. This is if Exxon fails to make a payment when it's due. Now, this is not interest on the amounts. This is not interest that's running now, but it's the federal statute. I don't know what the amount is. I can't figure it out. It's not tied to a particular amount. It's just tied to the tax and loan accounts. And I would ask an accountant or someone more familiar with finances what it means. The next provision is a reservation of rights. These are paragraphs 32 through 35. I consider them fairly, I'm sorry.
Normally, under the laws of the state of Alaska, interest on judgment is governed by ASO 9.30.070, as I recall.
10.5%.
So normally, if you'd have a consent decree, it would bear interest at that rate, if the consent decree were entered in a court of this state, or presumably, unless it was under some federal statute, even in federal court, because it would be domesticated.
Well, if you're talking about pre-judgment interest.
No.
Okay, you're not talking about pre-judgment.
Because this basically becomes a consent decree, mm-hmm. or judgment, so that it's not under Title 45.01.010, the general interest or pre-judgment interest statute, but it's under the Title 9, interest on judgments. This carries within it its own interest rate.
Yes. I'm not sure of the applicability of the 09 to this, as to whether or not it's tort claims.
I don't think that that would apply because this carries its own interest.
Right.
But I would like that to be checked out. Any questions for other members?
If I read this as supplanting the state interest rate.
Yeah.
The reservation of rights paragraphs are 32 through 35. They are fairly standard provisions. Paragraph 32 states that the agreement does not constitute an admission of fact, law, or liability. This is Exxon's way of saying the fact that I have given you money does not mean that I owe you anything. And they do that because they don't want admissions used against them in other contexts, other lawsuits. It is, however, I will admit, a fairly standard provision in any settlement agreement. Paragraph 33 states that the agreement does not create any rights in a person who is not a party to it. Paragraph 34 states that the agreement does not prevent the government from providing assistance or funding to those who are not a party to the agreement. And paragraph 35 states that the agreement does not impair any existing contracts between Exxon, Exxon Pipeline, and either entity of the government. They seem to be most concerned with bioremediation studies agreements, but I don't know of any others.
Representative Kabina.
Pam, on this section, it says that 32 says that it does not constitute any admission of fact, law, or liability. Does that conflict at all in that part of the whole agreement is that they are pleading guilty and does that not in itself admit fact, liability, or?
That's what they're saying is this agreement doesn't constitute it. Now, if you're talking about the effect of a guilty plea in federal criminal court, that's a different matter.
Thank you.
And I would say in general, a true guilty plea as opposed to a nolo plea to a criminal case will usually establish civil liability, or well, I should say liability, it will establish that you did that act under civil law because the standard of proof is higher in criminal law than in civil.
Have they agreed to plead guilty to the misdemeanors?
That was my understanding. That is my memory of that.
That's what I think.
See, the answer to that is yes. The plea agreement, which you should have in the book itself right behind there, Representative Kadena, is very specific. It's a guilty plea, and it does admit the act. There is a factual basis for the plea contained in the face of the agreement itself.
I was thinking this morning, I was reading this early on, and I was wondering how that plea agreement establishing guilt, or at least, you know, the company is going to plead that way, how does that affect third parties again? Will the court look at on those pleas as having some bearing on those third-party litigants' efforts?
The thing that they've pled guilty to, they have admitted that they have done for all purposes. Now, whether or not the thing that they have pled guilty to is also going to be the thing that a particular plaintiff has to prove in a particular lawsuit is a question I can't really answer. But it's certainly going to help. Yes. For instance, if in a civil case someone bangs into you and they go in and they plead guilty to negligent driving, then in your civil case, you essentially have established their, not necessarily their liability, you still have causation and damage, but you have established that they did that thing. They did it and that it was a violation of the law.
But the guilty plea must result in the act or omission which caused the damage. It may be that they pled guilty to not having a working headlight, but if the accident occurred in the daytime, that would have no causal relationship to the accident problem.
But if, in fact, if you plead guilty to breaking the or if you're guilty of something in the Clean Water Act, and somebody comes along and their livelihood is dependent on that Clean Water Act being adhered to, doesn't that then establish a certain advantage for you in the courts?
Well, there may be a problem here in terms of the Clean Water Act. I have been looking at the section that allows the federal government and state governments to recover under the Clean Water Act. I haven't looked through the Clean Water Act to see if anybody else could recover, and I kind of doubt it. I don't think that this is giving... Well, I shouldn't say that. They may have some, there may be civil claims that private litigants can make. I don't want to say that because I haven't looked for it. I've been concentrating on the state case here. But again, you have to look at, is what they are pleading guilty to what I am trying to say in another court that they did? And if it is, then their guilty plea is going to help the person in the third-party lawsuit.
Well, if, as my understanding from the reading I made, that you know, the guilt is one of polluting the waters, of negligently releasing pollutants into the water.
I would think that would help anyone that wanted to prove that their livelihood was damaged by that negligent release. Should continue. The other provisions, I spoke kind of quickly, there's notices and submittals. This just gives the addresses. People need to notify each other. These are the addresses that they should use. The next two sections are the interesting ones. One concerns the withdrawal of consent, and the other concerns termination. Now, under the withdrawal of consent, the notice of the consent decree is to be published in the Federal Register. The public comments are then received for 30 days. At the end of that 30-day period, either the state or the federal government, but not Exxon, can withdraw from the agreement if the comments show that it was inappropriate, improper, or inadequate, or if before the end of the 15-day period, the state legislature has not approved the agreement, quote, as written, end quote. And if either party, if either of the governments withdraws, then the agreement terminates.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I think that's rather significant also that it's the statement that has not approved the agreement. So we not only can reject it, we have to approve it.
Because if you do nothing, then the governor would have a reason to withdraw. However, as I think several people have pointed out, as we are all reading this, the governor is not going to be forced to withdraw even if you disapprove it. At least that is the way I read the document. The other thing, of course, that may be interesting is that either, it's interesting, it says that if at the end of the 15-day period, if the legislature has disapproved the agreement, it's possible that the federal government could use that as a reason to withdraw. I don't see anything in there that would prevent that. Interesting wrinkle.
Would you go with that again, please?
Sure. The two governments have 15 days to withdraw, and they sort of have to have some kind of excuse. And one of them is that the comments show that it would be improper, inappropriate, or inadequate. I suppose that there are no comments, and that couldn't be shown. The other reason is that if before that 15-day period expires, the legislature has not approved the agreement, failed to approve it, as written. I think that's the way. I better check that, just to make sure
isn't this
typing.
This is primarily what? Relative and comparative language. So how do you, how do you quantify relativity or a comparison, I mean?
Well, I think probably if...
what's inappropriate? What's inadequate?
That's
what's
a very
improper?
Good question. If one of the governments wanted to get out of it and Exxon didn't want to let them out of it, and this body, the legislature, had approved it, then that might become a question. It might become something that a court would have to decide. The one act that's quite definite is the legislature not approving it. 15 days expires if you haven't made an affirmative act approving it, then that is definite. And what I said was that would not only give the governor a reason, the state a reason for withdrawing it, as I read it, the federal government can withdraw on the same grounds.
I have Representative Davidson, then Covina. Representative Davidson, have you finished your question?
So what do we mean really? If the state withdraws its consent to the agreement, we don't define what we mean by the state. We don't define whether or not that means the withholding of approval by the legislature. What, in fact, does this paragraph mean?
I think the state is acting through the governor and the attorney general here in negotiating a lawsuit. So what they are saying is the state meaning essentially the attorney general. They've separated the legislature out as an entity.
So we've been tossed a dead fish?
That might be a little uncharitable, but you could look at it that way. That is with... Oh, I'm sorry.
No, Mr. Chairman, Pam, does this deal with the United States Congress in the same way? Is it? Do you understand that they could reject it?
No.
They have no say, saying?
They don't seem to have any interest, or at least under the agreement, they don't have any.
So would you say it gives the legislature, the state legislature, maybe some recognition where it doesn't the U.S. Congress at all?
Yes, I think that's true.
I think this was...
Representative Davidson.
I think on the strength of the Attorney General, I think it's why that's there. And for that, I'm grateful. But I don't think, you know, there's not much opportunity to flop one way or the other with it, as far as the legislature is concerned.
So you could, but all you can do is do nothing.
I might point out that there is legislation making its way through. It's House Bill 213 that will require that the state withdraw unless the legislature approves the agreement. Putting a plug for my own bill there, please.
The next paragraph, really basically the last one, is much important. Well, I shouldn't say that. One of the big last paragraphs. It concerns the termination of the agreement. Now, this is not the same thing as withdrawal. Withdrawal is either the government backing out. Termination can be done by any party, the government or Exxon Pipeline, if one of three things happens. Either a court of competent jurisdiction approves, disapproves, or overturns a plea agreement in the federal criminal case against Exxon. So if that criminal case drops out, then if the plea agreement is not accepted, then this consent decree terminates. I shouldn't say if that plea agreement, it says a plea agreement. If a court of competent jurisdiction makes the final decision that the agreement will not be approved or entered by the court. In other words, this is an agreement, but if the court refuses to consent to it so that it does not become a consent decree, then it also terminates. The third ground, should I stop there for a question?
Representative Davis.
Well, I'm sorry to interrupt here, but so Judge Sporkin, is it, I believe, he still retains some jurisdiction here, right? Is that?
No, he's back in D.C. It's I think probably Judge Holland.
Oh, I see.
In Anchorage.
Thank you.
Yes, this is to be entered in Anchorage. Okay. The Sporkin case dealt with certain native corporations suing. Different case entirely.
They went into district court in D.C. Mm-hmm. And the third ground for termination is if a court of competent jurisdiction modifies the agreement in a manner materially adverse to any party, or interprets the material provision in a manner inconsistent with the party's intentions, and that's all of the parties, before or at the time of approving the agreement. So the court is going to be looking at this, other people are going to be looking at it. The court says, oh, I think that that's what this means, that this provision here means X, and all the parties rise up and say, oh, no, that's not what it means, and it is a material provision, then that would be one ground for terminating it. Or if the court says, I'm not going to sign this consent decree, when it's written this way, you're going to have to change it. At that point, any one of the parties can terminate it. It doesn't terminate automatically. I perhaps made it sound as if it does. The way it would terminate is if a party must give written notice to the other parties within 10 days after one of these events occurs.
I'm sorry, had you finished?
Not entirely, but with that sentence, certainly, go ahead.
Okay. This strikes me as being a non-severability clause. The effect is that if any provision is struck down, any party may terminate the agreement. It's sort of, a severability or non-severability usually requires either the termination or the lack of termination as a matter of law. This allows any party to get out if any provision is modified or struck down. At any time.
Well, no, it's not the at any time. I puzzled over this because the sentence structure was a little confusing, and it's maybe something that we ought to look at more carefully. The way I interpreted it was that the modification or the interpretation contrary to the party's intentions had to occur before or at the time that the court approved the agreement. That this would not cover situations where 4 years down the line a court interprets something a certain way and all the parties... I have a hard time seeing this happen, but all the parties agree that this was inconsistent with their intentions. I don't think it would terminate then. I think that is the way I read that sentence structure, though I admit that I had to sit there and look at it for about 5 or 10 minutes before I had much confidence in my interpretation.
I agree with you. Okay. I stand corrected. Any other questions on paragraph 38? Please continue.
Okay. There is another provision of this, and one that was raised, an aspect of it that was raised at the last hearing, and that is that after termination under this paragraph, or if the parties withdraw and it terminates, the agreement ceases to be valid except that Exxon can get its money back from the escrow account, which certainly makes sense. And then secondly, the provisions of paragraphs 11 and 12 relating to cleanup continue, notwithstanding the termination. And there was some question about what that all meant. tried to figure it out. I think paragraph, if you go back and look at the cleanup provisions, paragraph 12 gives Exxon a set-off under certain circumstances for its future cleanup work. So that if this agreement destructs in some way or another, Exxon goes ahead and does cleanup work under the supervision of the FOSC or the FOSC, and the state, they continues to sue Exxon in state court, that Exxon, under this paragraph as I read it, can set off, it can reduce any amount that it that the state gets from Exxon by the its cleanup costs if it goes through the proof required under 11.
That's the
And it, so that this provision, paragraph 12, seems to survive even though the rest of the agreement may dissolve. That's the way I read it. And I have a certain amount of questions as to what, in a sense, the state got in exchange for that agreement. I guess what they got is the agreement to let this agreement go forward unless somebody backs out
tax
or terminates. But
Representative Davidson, did you have a question?
No, actually. I guess what I'm trying to figure out here is why is the negligent party being able to write off against their state tax obligation, or what would result as an indebtedness to the state? Why are they allowed to do that? I guess I don't understand why. I mean, what I was trying to figure out here was. I don't know the extent to which cleanup continues from January 1, 1991 to now. I don't know what's going on. I don't know what the federal on-scene coordinator has approved, nor do I know what the state on-scene coordinator has approved. But apparently something is ongoing. But it even includes anybody that, even Exxon employees, being paid for overseeing it on behalf of Exxon? I mean, it seems to me that we go back to 12 and try to understand that more. This is a wide open opportunity but of course there's the on-scene coordinator approval. So anyway, it just seemed like it was a monstrous loophole that a large wheelbarrow could go through.
You would have to ask the Attorney General why it is this way. I suspect that it is this way because as a result of bargain. This doesn't look to me like something that somebody overlooked. This looks like a bargained for provision, and I don't know why it's there.
How do we get to the bottom of this provision? Now, if we don't know why it's there, then can we dissect it enough to understand what some of the trade-offs were available to come up with the option that we arrived at?
Not by asking me, perhaps by asking some of the parties who negotiated it. I really can't guess. I suspect it's there because Exxon wanted it there and maybe gave up something else to get it there. Or it may be that the parties felt that was particularly reasonable, in which case, again, you'd have to ask them.
But to what advantage the state?
I don't see any particular advantage unless it might be to encourage Exxon to go do cleanup. I mean, that's all I can think of, but I'm just guessing.
Thanks.
Paragraph 11's relation to termination is a bit more complex, and this is the one that had people confused last time, and it had me confused. Because paragraph 11 says that Exxon has no further obligations with respect to cleanup after final approval. And are we therefore kind of letting them off the hook with this? Given the definition of final approval, this agreement is not going to extinguish Exxon's cleanup duty if either of the governments withdraws from it or if any party terminates it for any reason except the rejection of the plea agreement. And this is what I see as the potential problem here with extinguishing Exxon's cleanup duty. The difficulty would arise if the governments don't withdraw from the agreement. The court goes ahead and approves the agreement without changing it or indicating that it interprets it differently from the parties or anything else. The court's decision becomes final without an appeal. And at this point, under the definition of final approval has occurred, and Exxon's cleanup duty ends under paragraph 11. And then, thereafter, the court rejects the plea agreement, thereby allowing Exxon to terminate the agreement, but still, at least arguably, claim the benefit of paragraph 11B, which is that it doesn't have to do any more cleanup. But that is, I don't know how likely that is, but it's theoretically possible. And that's hideously confusing, and it's probably not the right time of day for any of us to try to understand it. When you're all fresh, you're going to go back over it. I'll try to finish here because there are just a few more. I also asked what the state received in exchange for the setup. I was curious about that. The next, in the next page, the court retains jurisdiction to enforce the consent decree. This is a good provision, because what it means is you don't just have a contract, but you have a court order. You can go back in there and get the court to do something quickly if one of the parties doesn't do what it's supposed to. The last section is a sort of standard one, but it did bother me. It says any modifications may be made only with the written consent of all the parties and the approval of the court. That doesn't bother me. It's a fairly standard provision. And then the parties, the representatives of the parties certified that they had authority to enter into the agreement and legally bind the parties to the agreement. And that's also not a fairly standard kind of provision, especially if you're dealing with corporations. But it raised the question in my mind is, what does this assertion by the governor and the attorney general, that they have authority to enter into the agreement and bind the state, is that going to prevent the legislature or any private party from coming in and challenging the agreement as beyond the power of the executive? In other words, if one of the parties, one of the provisions violates the state constitution, you want to say they don't have the authority to enter into this. And they said, oh, yes, we do. And what you have is an agent of the state asserting its authority. And how much is that going to bind them? Representative Gruenberg is saying, nodding his head, that it's not going to bind them at all. It may not. But I think you may sometimes have to give notice to anyone who might rely on that assertion of authority.
Let me just, for the record, make it very clear, and as we would say on Halloween, drive a stake through the heart of that argument. Since it contains the provision in here that specifically references approval by this legislature, I think that that couldn't be read in ignorance of that provision, and everybody knew that that was coming back to this legislature.
But would a third party, if you wanted to say that the governor had no authority or the attorney general didn't have any authority to enter into this agreement because it violates the Constitution, it's beyond his constitutional power, and then these other parties, Exxon and the federal government, are going to say, well, we relied on this assertion of authority, and nobody ever told us any different.
I still think that particularly entities of this type are presumed to know the law, and that would not override a constitutional prohibition item.
I would hope you're right. I wanted to raise the question because it did occur.
I appreciate that.
Is all I have for the...
Representative Kabina.
Can I back up once more, Pam, to this legislative approval issue on the previous page? Are you saying because this paragraph 37 does not specifically say the Alaska State Legislature has not approved the agreement as written, it doesn't say it is point blank that it is null and void if we don't, but it says rather that the government reserves the right to withdraw if they don't?
That's right.
And even though the government is not listed under the definition section, you're saying that you believe the definition of a government will be the governor?
No, the definition of a government is going to be the state of Alaska. And actually, it isn't in the definition section, but it's on page 2 at the very beginning. It says, the state of Alaska, the United States of America, collectively referred to as the government. So the state of Alaska is the state. But in terms of the, I think probably what the governor will argue is, the attorney general settles lawsuits, which is true. The state acts through the attorney general in settling cases, and that's what we've done here. And therefore, in withdrawing from the settlement, the state of Alaska is also going to act through the attorney general. That, I would expect, would be their argument. Now, what the effect of House Bill 213 is going to be is different, because then you're limiting by state law the authority of the attorney general.
Would you say that's absolute, or would you say there is an argument on the other side also that government, that the, if the legislature did reject that, that they also would have an argument as being the government? Would you say that would hold any water, or no?
I don't know. I'd have to think about that. Certainly the lawmaking power is vested in the legislature. The difficulty always is when you're talking about settling cases, you're usually talking about an executive function. I wouldn't want to be absolute and say that no court would accept that argument, but it is a difficulty with it, which is that this is usually considered executing the laws and therefore something that the executive branch does. Now, if you're talking about the legislature as part of its lawmaking power, limiting what the executive branch can do by law, that's a different matter, because then they can execute the laws, but one of the laws they're executing is the one you just made.
Okay, that brings us to the end of the discussion on this particular piece of contract. I'd like to announce for the committee that we have a committee secretary now who is already working and smiling over here to my right with Pat Williams. and she will be our committee secretary. And unless anybody has any serious objection, we'll be hiring, starting tomorrow, Andy Hemingway as our staff counsel, who was on my staff the last couple of years, and I think most of you know him. We are still on the lookout for a good economist or somebody in that area, and I frankly have to talk to several people again, would welcome suggestions, but I want to have us fully staffed as quickly as possible. I would ask members to please leave with Mona here their booklets, their three-ring binders for tonight. We want to make sure they are complete and up-to-date and in the correct order, and we'll get them back to you, promise, tomorrow morning. Yes?
I was wondering about tomorrow morning, as I say.
I'm going to get to that.
Okay.
Because of physical limitations on the part of human beings here, we will we are at the end of the road for the week. So we will not have to disturb your morning between 8 and 10, and we will meet next at 9:30 on Monday at In-House Resources, and from that point forward, In-House Resources. We appreciate Chairman Davidson's allowing us to use that room very much. So the schedule for Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday is from 9:30 to 11 on Monday. Tuesday from 12:15 to 2, that gives us a full 15 minutes for lunch, hopefully before, and we can bring our lunch if we don't finish. Wednesday from 8 to 10, all in-house resources, and then we will enter into the Easter break. Any other questions or comments at this point in time? All of these meetings will be listen-only teleconference. Public is welcome. Representative Davidson.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I would just like to extend our appreciation to Ms. Finley for her going beyond the...
she hasn't finished yet. She has two more agreements to go. And we will move through those agreements as well and anything else. And then we will immediately be inviting Attorney General and federal people and Exxon. And the preliminary indications are I hope we will be successful in having those people here personally. I would like to move through those next agreements as quickly as possible so we can even start maybe with the Attorney General on Wednesday. That's the latest. Any other business? If not, the time now is 6:27. Meeting's adjourned. Thank you all.
The next two portions are short.
Thank you. I think